Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will say for the sake of the audio record that today's date is January 15, 2025. This panel of the court today has four cases assigned to it, all of which will be submitted with oral argument. Our first case on today's calendar is case number A24-474, State versus Gall. We received a letter dated January 3 from Mr. Raggetts at the Attorney General's office informing the court of an intention to split time on the respondent's side. And Mr. Raggetts, is it still your intention to make argument?
It is, Your Honor. I will go first for approximately 7 minutes and then turn it over to the certified student attorney for 8 minutes.
Okay. We did not receive a motion for leave for a certified student attorney to argue, which is the norm.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. We must have missed that. I'm sorry.
I will entertain an oral motion.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to let her supervisor then move that, and a special assistant attorney general move for the attorney to argue. You're okay with that?
Is that, yeah.
Right, Your Honor, Megan Walsh, MEGANWALSH. I supervise student attorney Megan Zula, MEGHANZULA. I ask the court to allow her to argue today and apologize for the lack of written motion.
Okay. Mr. Gertz, do you have a response to the motion? Okay, thank you. The court will grant the motion. And so when it comes to respondents' time for argument, then, it would be our preference to avoid sort of back and forth between the two attorneys for respondent. We'll, to the extent possible, we'll try to exhaust all the discussion on the first issue and then turn to the second issue. Okay, so now, we are ready to hear arguments. As all of you likely know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and then appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Please approach the lectern. I will say that, in case you're unfamiliar with it, our lectern is adjustable. It goes up and down. There's a button, two buttons on the front edge of the slanted surface, right. Each of you can adjust it to your preference. When you begin, please state your name and the name of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Daniel Gertz. I represent the appellant, Mr. Gall, in this case. Please don't ask me to pronounce his first name. I can't do it. But Mr. Gall is, in fact, the appellant. The principal issue on this appeal is the question of reasonable suspicion and whether his seizure in Wilmer that day was a violation of the state and federal constitutions. What we had that brought it about was a caller calling the police who gives a false name. He then makes up a story about a shooting, which on its face is patently absurd. He promises to meet the police in a parking lot of the middle school to talk to them further about this story, but as it turns out, he's lying about that too. Doesn't show up. He then ghosts the police completely. They call him. He answers at first. He's evasive. Then he stops answering. Then he turns off his phone. So that's what we know about the person who provides the police with the basis for what the court determined was reasonable suspicion to effect the stop of Mr. Gall.
Counsel, can I just ask for a quick clarification? All those circumstances you described, did all that happen before the stop, or when did the stop happen in the course of that sequence of events you just described?
The stop did not happen. Well, the call happened. There was a period of time where they were anticipating to meet the caller at the school. I don't know exactly how much time passed there, but it wasn't a lot. I'm given, if my recollection of the records is correct, the total amount of time between the call and the actual stop was, I think, just less than an hour.
Okay. So, and I guess what I'm asking is, you know, the ghosting, whatever, that occurred before the stop of your client?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, it did. The story, and one of the reasons
Could I, Mr. Gertz, interject just with this question? I mean, even when the caller stopped cooperating, would you agree that it was reasonable for the officer to continue investigating this alleged shooting?
It was not only reasonable, it was required. There was nothing to corroborate what he had said. So without further police investigation, they would have had absolutely nothing, just this bare allegation from a person whom they know to be lying. And they knew it at the time.
Well, how do they, isn't, that sounds like an overstatement to me, that they know him to be lying. I think they were suspicious about his last name, the last name he provided.
The police testified that they did not even believe he was a real person, and they did not know how to find him.
Well, what do you mean, not a real person?
That he, well, I guess you'd have to ask the police officers that. It sounds like they knew that he was not giving them a real name. And they knew he was not giving them a real name for a couple of reasons. One, because of the context of the conversation, where they're going back and forth and he's being evasive. Second, because dispatch ran the name and found no person with that name in their database. So they had very good reason to believe that this was not a real person and that he had lied about his name.
Is it possible that a person could be evasive and perhaps dishonest about his name, but still be truthful or accurate in the information reported? I mean, it's a little bit unstated, but I had the sense that his behavior is similar to people who are concerned about retribution or being considered a snitch and having their personal safety at issue. Is that a reasonable interpretation, either by the officer or by the district court?
Well, you would expect one to say that. He did not say that in this case.
He being who?
He being the caller. He did not make such a statement or a expression of fear. And the fact that he was willing, if you want to say, I want to report a crime, but I don't want to tell him my name because I'm scared of what might happen, you can say that. That would not prevent you from meeting with the police, which he did not do in this case. Meeting with the police is not going to expose your identity. And he could have said so. He did not say so. I think in the circumstances of this case, that is not what we have. What we have is a person trying to get somebody else in trouble or trying to... It's a harassment technique to have the police, you know, sent to your door or sent to your car or whatever. In this case, he didn't even, his description of the vehicle did not match the vehicle that was stopped. His description of the alleged crime made no sense. He said he was close enough to be able to identify a license plate, which turned out not to be the correct license plate, close enough to identify the persons in the vehicle. Yet after several shots, the shooters were not able to hit the pickup truck that he was driving. And he claims that the quote was, he used the F word, but he said they almost hit us. They almost hit our vehicle, which, of course, the police know human beings would not be able to ascertain. He either missed or he hit. Obviously, In their investigation, they found nothing to corroborate anything about this.
I thought the record revealed that it was the caller identified a red Toyota.
I believe that's what the testimony actually was, or Judge Wenzel found that it was a maroon Toyota, and I'm not sure how that disparity happened, but I believe he described the vehicle originally as a red Toyota with a very specific license plate number.
Right, and the license plate matched a Mazda, but your client was driving a Toyota that night.
That's accurate.
Okay.
Mr. Gertz, is it your position that the only permissible way for the officer to investigate this reported crime was to talk to the caller? In other words, are you saying that it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment for the officer to have any contact with your client?
If there had not been a seizure of the client, then yeah, they could have called him up and talked to him if they wanted to. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that. But in this case, there was a seizure. That's not disputed. So we have a seizure. If they wanted to investigate it in some other fashion, as they should have, they certainly could have done so. But in their investigation, they found nothing to corroborate that any crime had been committed. As I pointed out, on its face, it's not credible. They found nothing to indicate that Mr. Gall was the person who may have committed the crime, if indeed a crime had been committed. But we know from the very beginning.
Well, the caller used his nickname, correct?
The caller described a person by a nickname, Deck or Dak or whatever. And it turns out Mr. Gall did use that nickname. What we have, though, is a tip that on its face is unreliable because the person is lying about their identity, and the police knew that. When you have a tip that's unreliable from the very get-go, the police have a much more difficult burden of corroboration. They need much more information to be able to act on it. And that's just standard reasonable suspicion law. Alabama versus White, if a tip has a relatively low degree of reliability, more information will be required to establish requisite quantum of suspicion. In this case, they didn't do it. The car he described, the license plate he gave, actually matched a real vehicle in the city of Willmar. They identified the person who owned the car. They identified where he lived. They just didn't see the car parked out in front of his house, which would suggest that the car was being used at that time. They ignored that and stopped a different vehicle with a different license plate number without having corroborated anything about whether a crime had occurred, and we know now that there's no evidence that it ever did occur. That they didn't have any evidence at the time that it occurred, or evidence to corroborate it, just the bare facts of what this caller had to say.
Why is it not enough corroboration? They had the nickname, and then they went to your client's dad and said, hey, we want to talk to him. Then your client then drove to his dad's business in a red truck. And so we got the nickname and the truck in terms of the cooperation that they have done at this point. So why is that not enough?
Well, no, there was no they have the name of a person that might be this person or not.
Well, the officer testified that I know this individual uses the nickname Deck. So
yes.
That's cooperation of, all right, this is an individual that I suspect may have been involved in this crime.
There is an individual with that name is all it corroborates.
And then he shows up in the same color truck that was described.
Toyota. Yeah.
Same Toyota.
He pulls up in a Toyota, same color, different license plate.
Right. Different license plate, same color.
And only one person in the vehicle, not two. So at that point, they don't have a lot to corroborate one, they haven't corroborated anything about the crime whatsoever. Two, so yeah, they have to have reasonable suspicion both to particularize the person suspected and that a crime occurred. merely identifying Mr. Gall as a person with a nickname, Deck, I think would have given them cause to investigate further, maybe talk to him, try to talk to him, as one might, as a police investigator might. It's the seizure that was unlawful. So I don't fault them for continuing to investigate and do what they needed to do to verify or dispel any suspicions they still had about the allegations. But they didn't have anything.
So your argument is essentially everything was fine until the one officer pulled up behind him and turned on the lights. Like, they had he not turned on the lights at that point, they could have continued to investigate and things could have proceeded.
If they had not seized him, we would have no constitutional violation. I agree with that. And they certainly were entitled to do what they thought needed to be done.
Mr. Gertz, before your time expires, I want to ask you some questions about your second argument based on the Second Amendment. So we have an opinion from our state Supreme Court from 2013, State v. Craig. In what ways, can you be specific, is Craig inconsistent with the current state of the law at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, Craig completely rejected what the United States Supreme Court said in both Bruin and Rahimi was the proper way to go about analogizing whether a current law meets the mark. It expressly said that was not necessary. It said instead the more appropriate inquiry is whether the Second Amendment as historically understood would permit such a restriction on the right to possess a firearm, regardless of where those laws existed at the time of the Second Amendment.
So let me re-ask my question again, I guess, focusing you on the U.S. Supreme Court's case law. I mean, which subsequent Supreme Court opinion, and I guess there's Bruin and Rahimi, I mean, which parts of Bruin and or Rahimi are inconsistent with Craig?
They require the historical analogical reasoning that Craig said was not required. That's the difference right there.
I mean, I think Bruin, in part 3A, asks whether the Second Amendment presumptively applies, presumptively guarantees the Second Amendment right with respect to this particular person and situation. And it concluded there that it did, because Cook and Nash, the two petitioners, were ordinary law-abiding citizens. And so then it went on but if a person is not, if a convicted felon is not an ordinary law-abiding citizen, then it seems to me that conclusion would be different at that first step, and there would be no need then to analyze further. Am I incorrect about that?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Did you are you referring to the scope of the right approach, where the argument that, well, the Second Amendment protections don't apply to certain people, period? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, I think that's part of the analysis in Bruin, in part 3A of the Bruin opinion. I don't think it's that much different from Craig.
Well, if Bruin was not clear on that, Rahimi was very clear that the right applies to all people. And we certainly can't interpret people in the Second Amendment differently from the way we interpreted it in the First and the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I think that Bruin said that Cook and Nash were people because they were ordinary law-abiding citizens. But so let's, as an illustration of this, let's turn to Jackson, the Eighth Circuit's most recent opinion in Jackson. You are counsel for the appellant.
I represent Mr. Jackson.
Right, and the Eighth Circuit ruled against you on this specific issue.
True.
Right? So, I mean, but there, the Eighth Circuit tried to discern whether there's a historical tradition of regulating firearms, restricting firearm possession among people who either are lawbreakers or prone to be lawbreakers and so on, and concluded that such people are not, that they don't have the same Second Amendment rights as people who are ordinary law-abiding citizens.
I don't believe that's what they decided. They decided that we don't need to have a felony-by-felony litigation in these as-applied challenges. we can take the dicta from Heller and so forth that this applies only to law-abiding, virtuous people. Rahimi made it clear that the Second Amendment rights apply to all people, not just a subset.
One more question, and that is, let's say if we assume for the moment that that Jackson is a correct statement of the applicable Second Amendment law, is that fatal to your argument, is there a way that you can distinguish Jackson for the sake of your client in this case?
Well, both Craig and Jackson are as-applied challenges. This is a facial challenge. So obviously you...
That doesn't help you, does it?
It does not help me, and I would concede that the law with regard to facial challenges has been even less successful than the as-applied challenges. There is a big circuit split, the second, the fourth aligning with the eighth, the sixth aligning with the third that just came out, that the Supreme Court will have to resolve. Mr. Jackson's petition for certiorari will be filed in a couple weeks.
Are there federal circuit court opinions since Bruin or since Rahimi that have taken a different position? And I think it's 921 G1, the felon dispossession statute.
Those as-applied challenges in the Sixth Circuit and in the Third Circuit, Range and I think it's Williams in the Sixth Circuit, both concluded.
Isn't Range about serial numbers?
No, Range was an as-applied challenge to the fellow who had the prior conviction for the food stamps.
Oh, it's for a nonviolent prior offense.
Yes.
Okay. Let me refine my question then one more time. Are there any federal circuit court opinions since Bruin that have held that the federal felon dispossession statute is unconstitutional with respect to a violent felon or a person who is convicted of a violent felony?
The consensus has been that nonviolent felons are the ones who can make a case, but that truly violent individuals, the law is not unconstitutional as applied to them. That has been the consensus.
Okay, thank you. I wonder if my colleagues have any questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gertz. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel, plural, for respondents. One of you may approach the lectern. Please provide us with your name and the name of your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. The plan is that I will address the first issue and only the first issue, leaving the second issue to my co-counsel. I have about 7 minutes to do so, so I'll try and be as brief as I can. This case does not involve a vague, unarticulable hunch. You have a concrete, specific, articulable tip from an eyewitness. And the eyewitness part of that is really important, that Deck, driving a red sedan, had just shot at him. So appellant's argument essentially is two things here, that that's not enough because A, it wasn't corroborated, and B, it's not reliable because he was a liar. So I'm going to address those separately. First of all, on the corroboration point, no case law requires corroboration from an eyewitness caller. It's different if the caller is saying something, but we don't know why the caller thinks that or how the caller knows that. But Timberlake doesn't involve corroboration. Claysmat, other cases do not involve corroboration. There is no requirement that you always have to have corroboration. And here we do have some corroboration. He knows the nickname of the guy who shot at him, and he identifies a red sedan. Now, I want to address the elephant in the room here. Yes, he got the license plate number wrong. But I think that, in a way, lends credence to the idea that he's telling the truth. Because if this is a setup, if he's come up with this plan to get Deck for some reason, he has some motive that we don't know about, wouldn't he have come up with the right license plate number? It seems far more plausible here that there's a very stressful, traumatic event. He's in a car he gets shot at, and he then tries to get the license plate number of the car, and he gets the wrong red car. But the testimony is these are similar red sedans. So the bad license plate number doesn't make him somehow per se unreliable or require additional corroboration. And again, case law is quite clear. When you have an anonymous eyewitness tip, you do not per se need corroboration. So the real argument here just goes to reliability, of course, and there's four things I want to say about that. First of all, no case law says that when a caller really wants to remain anonymous, and so when pressed, gives maybe a fake last name, that makes the caller a liar who can't be believed. There's no case law that says that. Wanting to remain anonymous is very understandable when you've been shot at. And if he had just remained anonymous, if he had said, after he said Eric and they pressed him on his last name, if he had said, I don't want to give my last name, we'd be in the exact same situation. An eyewitness who's anonymous. And in Claysmat, this court said, quote, Minnesota appellate courts have repeatedly concluded that an investigatory stop was lawful when the informant's tip was based on a personal observation. And that's what we have here.
Mr. Gragetz, you may have heard my question earlier to Mr. Gertz about the reasons why he was hesitant to provide his last name. I mean, was this developed and explored in the district court? Because, it seems to me the district court didn't say what I was thinking, which is that he's probably fearful of retaliation in some way. But why isn't that part of the record as far as I can tell?
Well, the caller was obviously hesitant about being identifiable to the police and being labeled a snitch or such. But he didn't say why. And the appellate court didn't.
You say obviously. Obviously he was hesitant.
Yes.
I guess what I'm saying is the reason.
Right.
The reason why is, I think, unspoken by everyone.
That's what I guess. I'm sorry, I misspoke. It was obvious that he really didn't want to give his last name. We don't know why. But reasonable article suspicion is a very low test. This court has often said that. You don't need a probability. That's probable cause. And so this is a reasonable explanation that doesn't undercut his reliability and make him just a liar who you can't believe anything he said. I mean, this is an objective test here. Would an objective officer have thought, well, if he doesn't want to tell me his last name, I can't believe anything he says? Not in this circumstance where he's talking about being shot at. So that's a reasonable explanation, and that's really all we need here for reasonable, articulable suspicion, where you have an eyewitness. That distinguishes all the cases appellant cites that involve probable cause or like jail versus Florida, where you don't have an eyewitness, you just have someone making an assertion that you don't know what the assertion is based on. So that was my first point, that just wanting to remain anonymous does not make you a liar who can't be believed. My second point is, kind of going to the common sense that underlines reasonable articulable suspicion analysis, if he was going to lie, he would have given the right license plate number. Or if he was going to lie, why not just SWAT him? Why not send the police to his house? I mean, somehow he happens to know that this guy's got a gun in his car that he's not supposed to have. And again, he identified the correct color and make of car, and he knew his last name, or he knew his nickname. It's also not true, going to a question asked, that the police knew he was a liar. I think you need to look at what the judge found here. There's no challenges to the factual findings as clearly erroneous. The officer was told by dispatch they looked up the phone number in the local record system, and there was no Eric Johnson with a complainant's phone number in the system. So all we know is that number doesn't go with an Eric Johnson in their system. It doesn't mean there's no one in the state named Eric Johnson. I mean, we have an attorney in my office named Eric Johnson. That's a pretty common name. That's probably why he gave the Johnson as the fake last name. So there isn't any concrete proof here. They knew that he could not possibly be Eric Johnson. They suspected it, sure. But reasonable articulable suspicion doesn't require you to eliminate all possibilities of innocence. And then the final fourth point I want to make on this is Judge Wenzel was not wrong when he said in his order that the complainant's phone number is known and is subject to at least follow-up investigation in an attempt to determine identity by searching records of the service provider by search warrant. So a reasonable objective officer would have known maybe there is something that could be done to try and identify this person. I think the key case really here is Navarrett. And Navarrett involves an anonymous call. Navarrett involves no corroboration. But in Navarette, they say it's important that it's an eyewitness. It's important that there was very little time to fabricate because the report was made right away. It was made to a 911 call, line, so it was recorded as it was recorded here and given to the judge. Navarette's very similar to this case, and again, the eyewitness part is really important here. Private citizens are presumed to be reliable. Just because you don't want to give your last name doesn't mean you're not a private citizen. I don't understand that argument. And time was of the essence here. The cops need to locate this just-used gun. They can't wait days. They're not going to find it. I knew my 7 minutes was going to go away really quickly. There wasn't a lot of argument on the Second Amendment, so if this court has additional questions that would eat into the 8 minutes, I'm happy to entertain them. But otherwise, I'll turn it over to my co-counsel on the Second Amendment issue.
It appears there are none. Thank you, Mr. Ragatz. Co-counsel for the state, as I said earlier, please, at the beginning, state your name and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Megan Zula, certified student attorney, supervised by attorney Megan Walsh, and we represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm the district court's decision that each of the challenged laws are constitutional. First, the crime of violence prohibitor was already found to be constitutional by the Minnesota Supreme Court in State v. Craig under a Bruin-adjacent history and text test. Second, the permit to carry statute is constitutional because the Minnesota Supreme Court held in State v. Hatch that it does not prevent eligible individuals from exercising their Second Amendment rights. And third, there is a complete cross-country consensus that statutes prohibiting serial number obliteration are constitutional under both the Bruin steps because there's no Second Amendment right to have firearms for criminal purpose. In effect, defendant wants the Second Amendment to be unfettered, a blanket right with no limitations. That is not what the law is. I would like to discuss the Bruin test and the burden.
Could I ask you to begin with Craig? Is Craig in all respects consistent with the subsequent opinions in Bruin and Rahimi?
Yes. Craig is still good law post-Bruin because it does what Bruin requires. It conducts a history and text test and provides historical analogs to back that up, which, while not, it didn't exactly comport with the language of Bruin, it's still consistent with what it needs.
What do you mean by the language?
Defendant said that it did not use the exact test per se, but it provides what is needed, the historical analogs, to come to its conclusion, and it didn't even reach the interest balancing which Heller used at the time. It only relied on history and text, though, so it's still good law. And also there's federal appellate...
The phrase that frequently is used in the Craig opinion is about the rights of law-abiding, responsible citizens. Is the word responsible still an appropriate use of the word in that circumstance?
Post-Rahimi, responsible isn't as emphasized. It's more law-abiding. And in this case, we know the defendant is not law-abiding with his previous conviction, the crime of violence charge for terroristic threats. So law-abiding is more the emphasized term, which we know defendant is not.
Okay.
So going back to whether Craig's good law, we have federal appellate court decisions that support whether a pre-Bruin case that relied on history and text is still good post-Bruin. Vincent v. Garland in the 10th Circuit and United States v. Dubois in the 11th Circuit. With that...
Am I right that the Vincent opinion was vacated?
Yes, but on different grounds post-Rahimi to come to a different... to take Rahimi into account and then come to a different decision.
But does it have any precedential effect after being vacated?
This is a different... There's no precedential effect, but this court could consider that no other circuit court decision post-Rahimi has changed their decision. They've come to the same conclusion. So Rahimi will likely not change that outcome.
Go ahead. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Crime of violence prohibitors across the board have been found to be constitutional. The only instances where it's not it's been nonviolent offenses, like range, which was an as-applied challenge for the food stamp fraud. There has been no appellate cases where there's been a facial challenge that has prevailed on these issues. And as Craig is good law, and this court would be an outlier if it decides otherwise, it should affirm the district court's decision for the crime of violence prohibitor.
And are there other, I was looking through your brief, looking for all the circuit court opinions, federal circuit court opinions I could find since Bruin. Are there any in addition to Jackson? I should say specifically about the felon dispossession statute, 922G1, I think it is, and violent felons. Are there any others that either are cited in your brief or that you otherwise know? And I guess what I'm looking for is sort of a model analysis that we might look to as being, you know, the most current, the most thorough analysis. Because the U.S. Supreme Court has never answered this question, correct? About the 922G1.
Correct.
And or any statute of the like. So I guess which federal circuit court opinion, in your view, provides the best analysis on that issue?
I would say Jackson. Jackson provides the most relevant and gone into detail regarding the first and second step here, and with being it's in this circuit, I think this court, if it wants a model answer, it should go in line with the Eighth Circuit's decision in Jackson to find that the felon prohibitor is constitutional. Moving to the second challenge statute, unless the panel has any other questions.
If possible, I'd like you to jump to the third, because we've got Craig for the first challenge from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Hatch for the second challenge, but there's no binding Minnesota Supreme Court on the serial number on the gun. So now we're looking elsewhere. What's your best case for the serial numbers?
For the best case, well, I mean, there's a complete cross-country consensus here that says that statutes prohibiting serial number obliteration are constitutional. There's only been one case that said otherwise, and it was later overturned by the Fourth Circuit. So we can look at a myriad of different cases that support this, because it's constitutional under both steps, because the conduct being regulated here has nothing to do with self-defense. It is just preventing the obliteration of the serial number on the firearm. They just have to keep that on to be able to remain lawful. It doesn't prevent anyone from exercising their Second Amendment rights, because they can obtain a gun that has a serial number still, and they just don't have to remove it or possess a gun or receive a gun unlawfully that has the serial number obliterated already.
You've cited, with respect to serial numbers, you've cited the Fourth Circuit's opinion in Price in August of 2024. Is that an opinion that you recommend to us as for its analysis of the serial number issue?
Yes. I would look to the Fourth Circuit because they looked to a district court case that came to an alternate conclusion and flipped that and came to the same conclusion as the rest of the country here, that it is constitutional under Bruin. In both of Bruin's steps. So that would be a case that I would look towards. For defendant asserts in their reply brief that this court should wait for Garland v. Vanderstock from the United States Supreme Court to come out, and that is not the case. That is an administrative law case, not a question of the case law's validity, as it is here. So this court should not be precluded from coming to their decision until the United States Supreme Court releases an opinion this summer. And as I am out of time, unless this panel has any other questions, I politely ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Zula. Mr. Gertz, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I want to address the clearly erroneous finding made by the district court, Judge Wenzel, in this case. He didn't describe it as a factual finding at all. He thought it was some sort of conclusion of law. And that's what we contested in our brief about. He relied heavily on this idea that use of the 911 system gives some sort of veracity to what people have to say. He relied specifically on the analysis in Navarrete, but It was a factual finding in Navarette as well, more than 10 years ago. I don't know what the evidence was before the court at that time regarding the technology. We know it's different today. We also have, in this case, a specific...
Can I ask you to go back? I'm not sure I understand. I mean, I thought Navarette provided a presumption that a 911 caller, sort of in the modern world, is likely to be truthful or reliable, and I think that the district court made reference to that here. What factual finding? What case specific factual finding are you referring to?
The factual finding that use of the 911 system permits the police to identify who the person was. And the record in this case is exactly, the only evidentiary issue or record on that is the testimony of the police officer who said very specifically that he has no way of locating the caller if he was lying about his name. And that's all we have in this record. So Judge Wentzel's reliance on...
The officer has the caller's telephone number, right, which allows for... further follow. I mean, I understood that the officer hadn't done that follow-up, but I don't know if the officer said that he couldn't or that he wouldn't.
His testimony was that he couldn't find him if he was lying. That was his testimony. And we also had the evidence that dispatch had tried to figure it out, and that they found no person that number didn't belong to such a person, or they couldn't, I don't know, they couldn't find it, couldn't find the name of any person like that. The record in this case, though, is that they were not able...
But, I mean, isn't it, I mean, aren't we all familiar through practice with the concept of subpoenaing a cell phone company for information about, you know, who is the person assigned to a particular number and so on? And that type of investigation sometimes leads to additional information, but right?
Well, no, because you get spoofed all the time from telemarketing companies. You try and use that.
It may not always work, but it can be attempted, and it might be successful.
In this case, the officer testified there was no way that he could find the person. That's the record we have in this case. That's the only evidence we have on that issue in this case. So Wentzel's reliance on a case from 10 years ago where the Supreme Court says, well, in that case, there was evidence, apparently, that you could use that to identify who the person was. And, you know, with landlines, that was always true, but that is not true today, and we know that. I do want to make another comment. Counsel was
talking... Before you move on to that, I didn't see in your brief where you're challenging the district court's finding as being clearly erroneous.
We say that it was improper and for the obvious reasons. He didn't make a factual finding about it, is the point. He simply relied on the statement from the court in Navarette that 911 calls can be presumed to be more reliable than other calls.
Okay, so you're not challenging the discourse factual findings. You're just saying that reliance on the facts as found was improper.
I'm saying that was, in fact, a factual finding that he made that is not supported by this record.
But that's what I'm not seeing in your brief.
Well, the brief challenges that, where is the brief? It challenges that at length. And we cite other cases that have gone into it.
I mean, you say the court erroneously lied on Navarette, made assumptions based on Navarette, those sorts of things. But there's nowhere that says in there that the district court made a clearly erroneous, that I can find.
The district court didn't think it was making a factual finding. So it's hard to, I mean, that they relied on a case that made a factual finding in a different case, when in fact the facts of this case contradict it. My time is up. No more questions. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gertz. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.